Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, and joining me as co-host tonight, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger, by now well known as a frequent co-host and guest on Your Legal Rights. Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of arenas. 6 to 8 months ago, we heard a lot about a changing landscape in the United States Supreme Court. Your Legal Rights looked at the court, considered whether the Supreme Court would ultimately decide the outcome of the presidential election. It did not. If any major game-changing cases were on the docket, and pondered how a newly reconstituted court might decide some of these pending cases. Last week, we picked up from there. With the last opinions handed down just last Thursday, we started to parse through some of these recent opinions and pondered just what did the court do, and what does this newly constituted court look like, and how that differed from the court at the start of the term. Tonight, we finish that look with part two. Our returning guests tonight are esteemed appellate lawyers engaged in the legal landscape of the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. Who better to look in the rearview mirror at the past year's decisions and perhaps look down the barrel of the Supreme Court to see what's likely to be coming up next? And while we're always eager to hear what's on your mind, tonight, as we close out this two-part series, we will not be taking listener phone calls. As always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice, as we don't have all of the salient facts of your case or of any case. We're happy to share the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making. Our guest views do not necessarily reflect the views of their employers or their clients. To
help us sort out just what is going on out there, first we have Ben Foyer, who's the chairman of the California Appellate Law Group, a boutique law firm specializing in appeals with offices in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. Ben has been called one of the top appellate litigators in California by a national news network and named one of the top 40 lawyers in California under 40 by the Daily Journal. Among other honors, he clerked on the Ninth Circuit, and he frequently writes on constitutional and appellate matters for publications like the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the National Law Journal.
Also back with us tonight, a partner at King & Spalding in the firm's Appellate, Constitutional, and Administrative Law Group, and Voights has worked on cases before the United States Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court, and federal and state appellate and trial courts. She's argued nearly 60 cases in federal and state appellate courts. Having previously served as a Supreme Court clerk, a Ninth Circuit clerk, and as a federal prosecutor with over a decade of public service, Ms. Voights is certified as a specialist in appellate law by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. To one and all, welcome back to complete our show from last week. Welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks. We're happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So as Jeff mentioned, this is a continuation from last week where we were talking about cases that came down in the last term from the United States Supreme Court. And there were a few fascinating cases that we just ran out of time, didn't get a chance to talk about. So, Ben, why don't you start us off this week and talk about Arizona Republican Party versus Democratic National Committee.
Thanks, Josh. Yeah, you know, so the reason, one reason we didn't have a really great ability to talk about this case last week is that the case didn't come out until after the show last week. So, or at least the opinion didn't come out. So we have a lot more to talk about than we might have had we even had time for it last week. So this case really touches on an issue that's been in a lot of the political news lately. And that has to do with limitations state governments are putting on election procedures and processes. Most of the news and the reporting that you see on this, of course, has to do with very recent changes that states are putting in place following the 2020 election and Trump's claim that he really won the election, if not for fraud. Of course, any sort of cogent and halfway intelligent listener knows that that is a lie. That's why it's being called the big lie. But it has a lot of political value. Certainly many of his supporters love hearing it and are delighted to hear it. And so states where the legislatures are controlled by Republicans have been putting in place a number of laws of varying degrees of severity that modify election procedures in ways that are very upsetting to Democrats. This case is based on modifications and changes to the Arizona election procedures that took place before the 2020 election. So this is not out of the very latest kind of laws that you've heard about, but out of ones that came a little bit before. This case in particular challenges two different Arizona voting procedures changes. One was a change that requires voters to vote only at the precinct to which they are assigned if they're voting in person, and they can't vote in other precincts that they weren't directly assigned to. And the other provision bans what are called ballot harvesting, somewhat pejoratively. But this is really where somebody in a community will go around and kind of collect everybody's mail-in ballots and then bring them to the polling place and drop them off. Both of these restrictions are alleged to impact minority voting more than non-minority voting. The idea is that minorities, or at least the allegation, the claim is that minorities may be kind of a little bit less educated about where their polling places are, or sort of devious election officials may change polling places in minority districts more often than in non-minority districts. And therefore, you're going to have a higher number of minority voters who go to the wrong polling location to cast their ballot. And also that in minority communities, it may be more difficult for folks to bring their mail-in or drop-off ballots to the ballot drop-off locations. Maybe because they're working and they can't get the day off, or maybe because it's more difficult to travel. Maybe there are fewer folks who have cars, especially for people who live kind of in inner cities. And the allegation is that that therefore, by eliminating the ability of somebody in the community to bring kind of everybody's ballot with them to the ballot place, that's going to impact minority voting more than non-minority voting. So those are the two provisions at issues. They were primarily claimed to affect Native American and Hispanic voters. You often, when you think of kind of restrictions on election procedures that affect minorities, you think of Black voters especially. But these were really focused on Native Americans, in fact, even more than Hispanic voters, but also Hispanic voters, both groups that have been subject to historical voting discrimination in Arizona.
But now, also in Arizona, don't some folks live pretty far out from the cities and in the reservations and the like? And obviously they're going to be affected a lot more than somebody who lives, you know, two blocks from a polling place.
I mean, it depends, of course, where the polling places are located. But if you have sort of, election officials who are up to no good, there's no evidence that election officials are up to no good, but you do have stories in many states where the number of polling ballot locations and polling locations have been reduced, and at least claimed to be more greater reductions in minority areas than non-minority areas. So that certainly is a concern. Although it's at this point unclear if that will in fact take place. But if you have a very, very large area or the polling place is very far away from where residents are mostly located, you know, it may be a lot more difficult for everybody to kind of get in their car or truck and drive to a ballot drop-off box rather than have sort of one person go around from house to house in a rural community and collect the ballots and drop them off. Of course, there are many places where non-minorities are in very rural communities as well. So it does remain to be seen whether these ballot measures, in fact, do have the kind of impacts that they are alleged to have. interestingly, I think, and I think it is important to kind of think about it and to talk about it. A decade ago, or at least over the previous decade, there was a big controversy on what were called voter ID laws. You've probably heard of them. These are laws that were passed in, I think, about 12 states that require anyone voting to present a state-issued photo ID in order to vote. The idea being that this will prevent so-called voter fraud, which, of course, does not really exist in the United States, not this kind of voter fraud where you kind of have people pretending to be other people. Doesn't happen. There's really no evidence that it happens in any kind of significant way. But this is something that Republican legislatures have been focused on, and they passed these voter ID laws. Democrats were really upset about this. They said that these laws would unfairly and without balance burden minorities, especially minorities in cities who may not own cars, may be suspicious of government, and are less likely to have IDs, state-issued IDs, than non-minorities. There was a big study done by Brookings in 2019 about these laws, and it found that both Republicans and Democrats were wrong, that there was no perceptible reduction or statistically significant reduction in minority voting in states that had enacted voter ID laws than before the voter ID laws were enacted. So in all likelihood, whatever presumptions were made about whether minority residents who wanted to vote would lack access to these kind of state issue identification cards, that turned out not to be the case. At the same time, there was also no sort of statistically significant reduction in in-person voter fraud, which was already extremely low. So Republicans were wrong. The goal that kind of Republicans had, oh, this is going to solve this voter fraud problem, it didn't happen. Although, again, voter fraud is not really a problem in the United States in this way. So really, there was a much ado in some ways about nothing in terms of the ultimate effect that these voter ID laws had. Republicans said, well, you know, at least they will reassure voters that might be skeptical of election fraud, that the elections are sound and sacrosanct. That didn't happen either. Republicans were just as likely to say when their candidate lost that that was a result of voting fraud as before these laws were put in place. So there was very little ultimate practical impact and effect of the voter ID laws. So they're trying other things, I guess, to reduce the turnout of folks who are perceived to be less favorable to Republican candidates. And that's really what's going on. It was sort of admitted by one of the lawyers in this case, representing the Republican the Arizona Republican Party, who said, hey, you know what? Elections are a zero-sum game. Our goal is to win elections. And, you know, that's there are a lot of ways that that may happen, including reducing and changing the demographic and nature of the voters who actually vote. That said, the Supreme Court said these changes to Arizona's election laws are okay. Now, this is a new kind of challenge in this case to voting practice restrictions. Up until 2013, there weren't very many of these types of cases because there was something called preclearance that was required under the Voting Rights Act. This is the Voting Rights Act of 1964. It was amended in 1982 in important ways. And, you know, at the time that the Voting Rights Act was originally passed in 1964, approximately 2% of Blacks in the South, and that's who it was really targeted at, were registered to vote. Today, it's obviously no longer that sort of a situation in the United States. So But the Voting Rights Act included a provision that states that had a historical practice of discriminating against minorities in voting had to, before they changed any of their voting practices, get approval from the Department of Justice. And that tremendously restricted the number of changes that were made to election practices in those states. In 2013, the Supreme Court, in a very controversial opinion, said that, hey, you know, yeah, Congress passed this law, but it's a weird law. It only affects some states. And, you know, we think that really if Congress wants this law to continue, you know, President Obama is in office, racism is over in America. And if Congress really wants to continue to require this kind of preclearance from the southern states, that it should pass the law again. It should go about, you know, figuring out exactly what the law it wants to pass and do it again. Of course, Congress has been paralyzed for the last decade. That never happened. So there's no preclearance anymore to changes to election laws. So now there are these kind of cases that are brought one at a time, and you're going to see more of them probably brought in the years ahead as states make more and more changes to their election regimes. There's a big one in Georgia where the Department of Justice just filed a lawsuit. But after this decision, in this case, it's going to be a lot harder to win those lawsuits because the Supreme Court here said, look, you know, these aren't really big changes that are a really big impact from these changes. One just says you've got to vote in the place you've been assigned to vote. The other one says you've got, if you're going to drop off your ballot, you've got to bring it yourself or have a family member do it. These aren't major changes. There's no evidence that these were specifically designed to reduce minority turnout as opposed to reduce the likelihood of fraud. And states don't actually have to show that there is fraud going on, but all they have to show is that, you know, this isn't really a statute has a big impact. There's a reason to think that it's designed at least to reduce the likelihood of fraud. And, you know, especially if you think back to when the Voting Rights Act was originally passed in 1964 and then 1982, everyone was voting in person. So restrictions on some of these weird changes, especially these coronavirus changes where everyone can mail in their ballot or you're going to have people driving to different polling stations than they were assigned. No one in Congress was even thinking about that in the 1960s and 1980s because everyone just went to their polling location. And so, you know what? This is fine. And that law is that reasoning is going to make it really tough going forward to challenge these kinds of sort of picky relatively minor you know, reductions in the way people are able to vote or the flexibility that people have to vote. There's very good reason to think that people should be free to vote as openly as possible, especially since there really is no statistically significant voting fraud in the United States. But the Supreme Court sort of said, look, if states want to make these changes, we're going to let them under the Voting Rights Act. Now, I personally think that probably the bigger impact from many of the changes to state election procedures has to do, especially the laws that are being put in place now, has to do with states that are arrogating to their legislatures the ability to override the will of the voters. I think if those laws had been in place, there are several states that have now passed these laws saying if the legislature decides there's been too much voting fraud in the election, the legislature can go in and direct which candidate will get the state's electoral votes. These are probably constitutional laws. The Constitution gives the power, tremendous amounts of power over how elections take place to state legislatures and how the electoral votes will be handed out. But throughout almost all of U.S. history, electoral votes have, in one way or another, been given out based on the result of the popular vote. And you can certainly imagine in 2020, had states had this power already, that there are some states with very Republican legislatures, even swing states, that voted for President Biden, that where those legislatures would have faced tremendous pressure to sort of throw out the popular vote and award the electoral votes to Donald Trump.
But in terms of what the Supreme Court just came up with on Thursday, didn't they in essence come out and say, look, when the state creates things that really hits hard minority voters, then come talk to us?
Basically, that's what they said. That's pretty much what they said. And of course, who decides when the state kind of hits minority voters really hard is open to a very subjective interpretation.
And probably not the advocacy of the state next door, because as we learned in other cases this term, there are limits to how far the court's going to entertain those things. Those arguments. Yeah,
that's right. The court is not going to be interested in one state suing another state based on the result of its election. In fact, Texas tried to do exactly that. I think tried to sue Pennsylvania, saying that Pennsylvania's changes in its election law, allowing mail-in ballot and so forth, was denying their right to have Donald Trump be president. The Supreme Court did not even consider that statute, that lawsuit. They refused to even consider it. It's a nonsense lawsuit. It was brought for political reasons. But but I think what another sort of thing to consider is that in some of these states that are really close in terms of their division politically, very small changes really might have an ultimate outcome difference, right? We have a system in the United States. In most states, states don't have to do it this way, but almost all states award all of their electors to whoever wins the popular vote. Now, states could divide up their electors based on kind of what the divisions are in the states. And in fact, there is an effort out there to have states pass laws that would award their electors proportionally to their vote share. But almost all states do it as a whole. And so in a state like Georgia, where you had a fraction of a percentage point, I think, ultimately deciding the difference between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, a small reduction in the turnout of a group that's more likely to vote for one or the other could have a dramatic impact on the ultimate result.
Let's move on from the voting rights stuff. I think that's going to be playing out a little bit. It's going to be that much harder for people to get their cases to the Supreme Court. And we're going to see how that plays out and whether the end result is that it charges up minorities who feel that they're trying to be kept down, people are trying to keep them down again. Maybe that will bring enough people to the polls that weren't so interested that it'll have the exact opposite effect. I think in the next several years, maybe as early as next year at the midterms, we're going to find that out.
Absolutely. Democrats are making a huge deal of this, largely for that reason, because they really think this is a big vote driver.
Some of the other things that have come down and that we didn't get a chance to talk about last week, one of them had to do with accessing systems you're not supposed to access, but perhaps it may not be criminal because you're authorized. If I have that right. And can you talk to us a little bit about Van Buren?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the case is Van Buren versus United States, and this was another case that came down after our last session, in part because, well, we're not quite sure, because it was a relatively straightforward decision, 6-3, an interesting mix of judges. This was a majority opinion by Justice Amy Coney Barrett in dissent, written by Justice Thomas and joined only by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. This involved, one of the court's first serious looks at a really important criminal statute that involves computer-related crime. It's the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And as you might guess, a statute written in 1986 for computers may not be completely relevant to the way that we use computers today. And that was one of the things that I think the court was struggling with. So this is an interesting case because it raises a couple of different things. One, how do you deal with a statute that is arguably not, drafted with our current status quo in mind. Second, what do you, you know, how the Supreme Court has responded to what it views as the Department of Justice's overreach when it comes to interpreting certain criminal statutes. This has happened previously in Bond versus U.S., where they said, look, you know, it may be criminal for somebody to try and assault someone by leaving a toxic substance on their car, but that doesn't make it sort of a war crime. And in this case, too, the issue was whether a Georgia police officer named Nathan Van Buren violated the CFAA by taking a bribe to run a license plate check. Everybody agreed he was entitled to run license plate checks, but he couldn't do it for illicit purposes. He could only do it for the purposes authorized under his job. And the question was, did that actually violate the CFAA, which criminalizes conduct that exceeds authorized access of a computer? So the real question was, what does that mean? You know, if the language says to access a computer with authorization and to use such access to obtain information that the accessor is not entitled so to obtain, what does that really extend to? And what the court said is, look, this, the lower courts had said, it's okay under the CFAA, this is actually a violation because he wasn't entitled to check license plate records for private purposes. And the Supreme Court really cut back on that. They said, no, look, under the CFAA, it's a crime only if they access information they were not entitled to obtain. We're not going to look at the specific purposes and try and parse between whether they're authorized to use it for one purpose or not for another. And so it really turns on whether you're entitled to access it, not the purpose for which you are doing so.
And let me ask you a follow-up, if I may. It would seem that understood that this was very antiquated to today, but if you were to read that the statute strictly today, couldn't it criminalize using a website even for a means in which that website was not designed? The website has the user, you know, you agree to it. That's the purpose of the website. That's why we set it up. And you took the information for a completely different purpose. Under that strict reading of way back when, wouldn't that make it a crime to even access a private website?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that Barrett focused on in her opinion. She said, look, this would criminalize every violation of computer use policy. If I gave you my password so that you could access my Facebook account and that violated the terms of use, does that make it a felony? You know, and she said this would essentially, right, because it would violate the Facebook terms of use. And under the government's argument, you know, it would have encompassed this really broad spectrum of behavior. You know, anything that violated a private policy as to how you use a particular website or how you use a particular account. And she said, look, if you're talking about using a pseudonym on Facebook, that may be a bad thing, but it shouldn't be a felony, at least not a felony under the CFAA.
You would, in essence, have private entities drafting criminal laws. In right. a sense, they would be setting up their own policies. You know, violate the policies. They could call the DA or the U.S. attorney. You would have private entities such as Facebook, in a way, setting up criminal laws.
Right. Absolutely. And she said, you know, this is this. There are already statutes, as they viewed it, that can criminalize this conduct and that adequately care, you know, cover it. So why would you adopt this extraordinarily broad reading that would turn, you know, millions of otherwise law-abiding citizens into potential felons? And that was something that was really heatedly debated at oral argument, you know, them coming up with multiple hypotheticals. And how do you really limit this? And I think it was the government's inability to come up with a limiting principle that ultimately sort of sunk their case.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Nicole Dorsey's film Black Conflux is inspired by a series of unsolved missing women cases in Newfoundland and Labrador during the 1980s. It's now being released in theaters, and Nicole shares why she chose this story to be her first feature film. It's coming up on Q from PRX.
Q from the CBC, just ahead at 7 o'clock, followed by All Songs Considered for the 8 o'clock hour. Here on 91.7 FM, KALW in San Francisco, and online at KALW.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.
You're listening to a special edition of Your Legal Rights. For tonight's program, we are not accepting calls from listeners.
One. So the last case that we were talking about was interesting, but I'd like to change directions just a little bit. Talk to me a little bit about the court and whether states such as California can force disclosure of some of the donors of some of these nonprofits.
Yeah, this is an interesting kind of quirky little case. It might have bigger implications in the long run. I suspect not. But we will see. It's a case called Thomas More Law Center and Americans for Prosperity Foundation against Bonta. These are conservative groups. The Thomas More Law Center is a conservative law firm that brings lawsuits to push conservative causes. Americans for Prosperity Foundation is, I believe, funded by the Koch brothers, who are very famously kind of conservative libertarian promoters of those causes in all different forms. And this relates to a law that California has had in place for quite some time that requires many charities and nonprofits to disclose to the state attorney general's office every year the names and addresses of their largest donors. And the attorney general's office says, look, we do this because we want to ensure that there isn't fraud. We want to make sure that folks are not using charitable organizations for kind of their own purposes or trying to funneling money through it. We heard recently about a lawsuit brought by the state of New York against the Trump Organization, in fact, criminal charges on kind of issues involving how that nonprofit was being run. And so California is saying, look, you know, we have a really strong interest. There are a lot of nonprofits that operate in California and are based here. And we have a really strong interest in making sure that they're being used correctly. These organizations, on the other hand, say, look, we have a really strong interest in being able to engage in speech that's important to us anonymously, because if we have to disclose this information to the state, we are really worried that there is going to be backlash against us, that our information is going to leak out of who our big donors are, and that our people who might give money to us are going to be dissuaded from doing so because they're going to know that we're going to report that to the state government. And you can kind of understand that also in a state that has particularly liberal on certain issues. You know, there would be probably in many areas, there might be some real opprobrium to finding out that your neighbor is giving millions of dollars to anti-gay causes or any other really undesirable and unpopular cause. This really pits California's interest in preventing fraud against the donors' interests and the foundation's interests in being able to engage in speech and being able to associate with and get donations from folks who without having kind of a public opprobrium against them. Now, California says that it keeps their information private, but there have been so many leaks and breaches of privacy from the California Attorney General's office on these donors, on exactly this issue, that the ACLU, in fact, filed a brief in this case on the side of the conservative organization, saying, look, this promise of confidentiality is illusory. It doesn't really exist because California is such a mess in how it's run at least at the state government level, that you just have no reason to believe if you're a donor that your information is going to be kept private. And the Supreme Court ultimately agreed with the foundations. They said, look, you know, California sort of has an interest in policing fraud, but there are a lot of ways to police fraud. For example, California might say, look, we're only going to ask for who your donors are once we have a reason to think you might be doing something improper, or that California is going to police fraud by looking at all different kinds of other issues in the way that nonprofits are run. It doesn't really have a very good explanation for why every single nonprofit in the state needs to tell the attorney general's office who its biggest donors are every single year. And against that, of course, the people, individuals have a relatively meaningful First Amendment right to engage in speech anonymously and to be able to engage in speech through money by donating money in a way that they don't have to be worried about kind of their neighbors picketing on their front lawn because they found out they're doing something that's pretty unpopular.
Well, Ben, let me follow up on what you just said about money and basically PAC. Anytime we talk about this, I think for quite some time, people are going to be thinking about Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which is a landmark decision of the United States Supreme Court in 2010, I believe, concerning the relationship between campaign finance and free speech. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the court held that the free speech clause of the First Amendment prohibits the government from restricting independent expenditures for political campaigns by corporations and committees established for the purpose of fundraising or PACs. How does this decision, if at all, or how was it impacted by Citizens United? What impact does that case have on this?
Yeah, there is an election law element, or at least an election law related concern about what the Supreme Court did in this case. It's not directly tied to Citizens United. You're right. What the court said in Citizens United is that corporations and unions, which were otherwise restricted by law, have a First Amendment right to engage in independent speech by spending their own money without coordination with a political candidate or campaign to further a cause that they or candidate that they think is important. Previously, this was limited by statute. Now, that has been a very controversial case. Many people very upset by the result. This case is a little bit different, although there is a connection, because in Citizens United, what the Supreme Court said is, look, if Congress wants, while it can't tell corporations and unions and other sort of entities that they can't engage in independent speech, Congress can require a lot of disclosure. If Congress wanted to, the court said, on all these TV ads that are independently funded that say, you know, paid for by Americans for the Future Political Action Committee. You have no idea who's behind that when you just kind of see that name. So the Supreme Court said, look, if Congress wanted, it could require disclosure of folks who are funding these groups or contribute to these groups, and that could be made publicly accessible, and then people would know who is engaging in this kind of independent speech. And that's the case in general in many states, and certainly in certain ways when you're giving money directly to candidates. At the federal level, you're required, the candidate is required, if you've ever done it, you'll know the candidate's required to take your name and your occupation, and that gets put into a federal election committee database, and you can actually go on the web and you can search and you can find out if certain individuals donated money directly to candidates. You can't do that for private organizations. So the Supreme Court and Citizens United said if Congress wants, they can. It never happened. Of course, Congress has been paralyzed on any really controversial issue for the past decade. And so that's probably why. The concern with this case is that the reasoning employed here, where the court said, look, there is an important First Amendment right to engage in anonymous speech. And, you know, we're worried about people really being embarrassed in front of their neighbors because they hold views that their neighbors may not approve of. So the state of California can't require this kind of disclosure, that, you know, that kind of reasoning would also be applied to election law. That the court might at a later date, based on this case, say that the federal government's requirement, either that the court talked about in Citizens United, the requirement that's never put in place, or the requirement that exists with regard to campaign donations to candidates, that requirement violates the same anonymous speech principle from the First Amendment that they talk about in this case. I think that's probably unlikely. You never know. Obviously, we will see. A lot of folks are worried about it. I suspect that's unlikely. And the reason I think it's unlikely is because one of the probably deciding factor, one of the really big deciding factors in this case, was that the state of California did not have a very good reason for wanting this kind of mass disclosure. As I mentioned, there were so many more narrow ways that the state could, and the court really said that it could get this kind of information about who donors are to these nonprofits, if it opens an investigation, if it has some reason to ask a specific organization for its donor list. There's nothing about this opinion that would restrict that. This is about en masse, kind of just everybody has to, at the beginning of the year, give, or whenever during the year, give this information over to the state. Election law, there is a much stronger and more clearly articulable purpose to saying, look, and the court has said this in the past, that there is a compelling governmental interest in preventing not just corruption, but the appearance of corruption. And one way to prevent the appearance of corruption is to make sure people know who is messaging to them on political issues in the context of a campaign. So it seems to me that there is a pretty big difference between those two. But of course, who knows what the court will decide in the future. And it's one of the things that many of the commentators and the dissenters in this case were really concerned about.
So we talked a little bit about some of these cases, in particular, the cases that were handed down that affect voting rights. What are some of the hot button issues that they are looking down the barrel at now? Any petitions for cert that are pending that we know a little bit about?
Sure. Well, we talked about some of the petitions during our last session, some of the interesting ones that have been granted. There are a couple, though, that the Supreme Court's going to be thinking about. And just for listeners' background knowledge, the Supreme Court isn't going to act on any petitions barring emergencies until what's called the long conference in the fall. So over the summer, the clerks will wade their way through all of the petitions that come through. And then at the long conference, the justices will try to fill up at least some portion of the remainder of the term. One of the interesting cases, though, that they have where the state of Ohio has filed a petition, though, is Ohio versus Doyle, which involved a case where an undercover officer was impersonating a teenager online and was contacted by Daniel Doyle, who arranged to meet her in a park, or who he thought was a teenager. And the officers saw him playing basketball. They saw him using a cell phone when the undercover officer sent messages pretending to be the girl. They detained him and confiscated his phone. And then they sent another message and saw a notification on his phone confirming that he was, in fact, the individual who was communicating with the undercover officer. So the trial court said that's enough probable cause for detention, because under the Fourth Amendment, you have to have probable cause to stop for an actual detention. But the Ohio appellate court reversed and said, look, you don't have probable cause until after his phone was searched. And he had an expectation of privacy in his phone's notification screen. This was based on a Supreme Court case called Riley versus California that said you can't search people's phones without a warrant. That was a pretty substantial decision. And this is a good example of how, even when we think the Supreme Court has answered questions, there are always sort of spin-offs that come up. So this is a question of, you know, do you need a warrant to actually go ahead and just look at what pops up on someone's screen, their notifications? And as a general matter, you know, this is one where the state has petitioned for cert. Usually when either the state or the federal government petitions for cert, there's usually a slightly better odds of it getting granted. And if it does, you know, that'll be an interesting way for the Supreme Court to address whether or not, you know, Riley versus California extends more broadly than, you know, unlocking a phone and looking at it. So we'll see what happens with that.
So there are some other issues that are pending now. Some of them are in the lower courts, but some are political on their face. One of them is the fact that the present administration has not filled a position. I'll leave that in a moment. But another one has to do with the makeup of the court itself from a political perspective. And we've heard lots of chatter in recent weeks about whether one of our sitting justices should retire. We've heard chatter in the months before that about possibly packing the court or trying to put term limits on the justices or age limits. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the politics behind these things, and then we can move on to filling out some of these positions within the Justice Department as well?
Sure. Well, I think it's fair to say that, you know, as long as there have been legal academics, there has been speculation about how to do better with the Supreme Court, and particularly as confirmations have become so politicized, so that in this case, I think basically as soon as President Biden took office, you know, there were people who were advocating for Justice Breyer and others to retire so that younger justices could be appointed to take their place, President Biden did create a commission that's supposed to look at the courts and think about whether or how, you know, there should be changes made to, you know, the numbers of judges and justices, how they're appointed, all of that. You know, there's never going to be perfect satisfaction with the composition of that panel. And I think some of those who would like to see more aggressive changes or more aggressive reforms were somewhat disappointed with the composition, but we'll see what happens. But Ben, I'm interested in your take.
Yeah. So, I mean, the question of kind of what to do with the Supreme Court, when the country was founded, the Supreme Court did not have 9 justices, right? It had 5 and then 7 for a while, and then it moved to 9 in the 1800s. And you may recall hearing about court packing during the Roosevelt era. During the New Deal, there was a justice, very conservative majority. And the court in 1931 and 1932 shot down, essentially found unconstitutional, a number of Roosevelt's New Deal packages. So then one of the justices very famously changed his vote on minimum wage laws, which is the only reason we have minimum wage laws today. And that's been referred to as the switch in time that saved 9, because before then, when Roosevelt was frustrated seeing all of his very hard fought, what he thought was very important New Deal legislation shot down, he was really pushing Congress and was really using all of his influence to try to get Congress to approve more justices for the Supreme Court. And of course, he would be the one who would get to appoint them. And as long as there were some more justices, he would have a majority, and then he could pass his New Deal laws. Turned out to be a very unpopular effort, despite the desire by many to have some of these laws be put into effect. Congress really pushed back hard. The American public seemed to really not like the idea of messing with the institution of the Supreme Court. And Roosevelt ultimately had an easy way to back out when one of the justices changed his position and started voting with the liberals, and then the justices started retiring at the time, and Roosevelt ultimately appointed a number of justices to the Supreme Court, all of whom approved many of his plans. Fast forward, what is this, almost 100 years, 90 years, and we still have 9 justices on the Supreme Court, and we now have a 6-3 conservative majority on the court, and liberals are really upset by this. In part, the reason we have a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court is because of a change in 2013 by the Democrats, Harry Reid, who removed the filibuster as it applied to the appointment of lower federal court judges, district judges in the trial court and court of appeals judges at the appellate level, not Supreme Court justices, just the lower court judges. And that was in reaction to a lot of the opposition. Democrats had a bare majority in the Senate at the time. They wanted to get these judges in place with 50 votes, not 60 votes. And so Harry Reid changed this rule. Ultimately, Democrats very soon lost the majority in the Senate. That sort of prevented President Obama from appointing further justices, including judges, and including most famously Justice Merrick Garland. But when Trump came into office, this change by Harry Reid worked to his tremendous benefit. Many people will say that Trump's greatest accomplishment was that he appointed about a third of the federal judiciary, and he did, but he only was able to do that because the Republicans only needed 50 votes for the first time since, I think, the 1920s. And then when the Republicans, it was very easy for them to extend this change in the filibuster rule to Supreme Court justices. And now you only need 50 votes to get any of these folks in. So you have a very conservative majority on the Supreme Court. This is upsetting, of course, to Democrats who think they're going to get through a lot of legislation in the Senate and with President Biden and control of the House, but it'll be shot down by the Supreme Court. So far, they haven't gotten that legislation through, but we'll see what happens in the future. There's been this kind of effort on the left or the far left to bring back this court packing idea that the Senate should create more justices that President Biden could appoint, and then that would kind of allow Democrats to have liberals to have a majority again, and maybe would be better for other reasons, including the size of the country or the complexity of the court's docket. This is, again, not really gotten any traction outside of the far left, very far left progressive movement. There really isn't all that much interest in doing this, and it would be very politically complicated. There has been efforts, though, over the past 10 years, 15 years or so, to think of other ways that the Supreme Court could work that could remove some of the animosity about the justices and their appointment. One of which is to have Supreme Court justices have 18-year terms on the court. And if set up the way that it's kind of been proposed, that would basically allow each president to appoint two justices per term. It would be, they'd be on set schedules. It wouldn't be as much of the end of the world in some ways for the other side politically to have a justice of the other party appointed, because justices today, I mean, Amy Coney Barrett can be expected to be on the court for about 40 years based on her life expectancy if she wants to. That's a long time to be on the court. So 18-year terms is one of the ideas that's been proposed. It's also very tricky to get into place. You're going to have to remove the filibuster in the Senate, or Democrats would have to get a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority to pass legislation. It seems very unlikely to happen for that reason, even if it might lead to a little bit more of a rational and less kind of frenetic process for appointing justices.
So one of the things that we did hear about is whether one of our sitting justices should retire. And we were talking about this a little bit before we went on the air, about what's motivating some of the folks that thinks that he should. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? We have about 3 minutes left.
Sure, just very quickly. You know, I think there was a lot of pressure put both publicly and privately on Justice Ginsburg at the time to retire during President Obama's tenure in office. And obviously the person who replaced her, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, is very, very ideologically different than Justice Ginsburg. And so as of day one, when President Biden was inaugurated, discussions began publicly about whether Justice Breyer or others should go ahead and retire to create a spot for someone who is perhaps younger. By all indications, there certainly was no announcement of retirements, or at least not the retirements that people were looking for, when the Chief Justice gave his annual end of term discussion and mentioned the various staff members who retired. Justice Breyer has given no indication that he intends to retire in the near future. So we'll see what happens.
He's 82, is that right, Anne?
I think that's
right. Yeah, up there.
But it's also been understood that as long as they're performing and able to do their jobs, kind of understood that they could, that justices of the Supreme Court are appointed to sit for life for as long as they want to. And
it's certainly, I think no one would contend it's an issue with any of the current justices, but in the past there have been justices who, perhaps overstayed their abilities. I think Justice Douglas was a famous example of that, an extraordinary justice in his time, but one who stayed perhaps longer than he should have.
And on the other hand, you have examples of justices who retired earlier than they might have otherwise for one reason or another, and then sort of kind of publicly regretted it. You think about Sandra Day O'Connor, for example, who retired because of her husband suffering from an illness. And then I think she was pretty clear that she missed the job. She had, you know, maybe had another 10 years left had she wanted to stay on the court. You know, you kind of wonder, you know, these folks, they're human beings too. They probably wonder what they would do if they lost this very interesting job. It's certainly one that can keep your mind agile. You're dealing with very challenging and interesting issues with a lot of young, you know, very smart law clerks and fellow justices. Ultimately, it, you know, and partly depends on your political, how important getting a justice in place who mirrors your political views are. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said the primary reason she didn't retire when President Obama was in charge and there still was a filibuster in place is she didn't think that they would be able to appoint a justice who was as liberal as she would have liked to see. And so she thought she'd sort of wait around for a more liberal a bigger majority in the Senate, you know, or a different time when she thought that that would happen. Of course, it didn't. And, you know, a lot of Democrats are still, I think, and probably will for a long time, ruining that fact.
And those will be the last words that we have for tonight. But I'd like to thank both of you for coming, for participating. It's been a great 2 weeks.
You've been listening to a special edition of Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We've just completed a two-episode look at the just-completed term of the United States Supreme Court with, from King and Spalding, certified appellate law specialist Ann Voights, and Ben Foyer, chairman of the California Appellate Law Group. Our show tonight has been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 p.m. Again, a big thanks to tonight's guest, Ben Foyer and Ann Voights, and especially our thanks to all of you for joining us and tuning in. For Josh Borger and at the controls, Damian D. Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Refer Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can dial 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org. Thank you.